Hello and welcome to the Eclipsing History Podcast, a podcast where we explore the social, cultural, and political significance of eclipses through the diverse cultures of North America.
This is episode 1, Total Eclipse of the Swamp. You can find the entire series and additional information at pgsu.edu/eclipsinghistory.
Hello, and welcome to Eclipsing History. The story we have for you today is one of power, religion, betrayal, and survival. It's a story over two centuries in the making, and something that continues to shape American society to this day. This is the story of the total solar eclipse of 1806 and the incredible events it inspired. Welcome to the Great Eclipse of the Swamp. The date is June 16th, 1806. Imagine you're standing in a large clearing surrounded by trees. It's mid-afternoon in Greenville, Ohio, and there's a lot of tension in the air. As you look around, you'll see two groups of people standing on opposite sides of the clearing, both anxiously awaiting a moment of truth. The first group you might notice right away from their outfits. They're soldiers of the United States Army, led by General William Henry Harrison, 34 years before he would become the country's 9th president. He stands with one hand resting on the hilt of his saber, fastened tightly to his belt. He's filled with eager anticipation, because this is a moment he's been looking forward to for almost 3 months now. Across the clearing stands another group, a collection of indigenous people representing the Shawnee. At their head are two individuals who had made spectacular rises to fame in recent years. One is Tecumseh, an experienced Shawnee war leader who had made his name as a staunch opponent of settler colonialism in his homeland of Ohio. He'd fought in Little Turtle's War 15 years prior, a conflict in which his older brother was killed by an American militia. But standing beside Tecumseh is his younger brother, Tenskwatawa. He's known to his people as the Prophet, and he is the one everyone looks to today. This is an important occasion for both parties, and, as it would turn out, for the history of North America. The Prophet had spent the last several years building a powerful following amongst his people. His message of spiritual revival had made him incredibly popular, and it was this popularity that caught the attention of Harrison. Harrison was the foremost American official in the Ohio Territory, and he'd watched with displeasure as the Prophet's religious following grew steadily larger. Seeing him as a threat to westward expansion, he'd decided something had to be done. And so, before various indigenous witnesses, he issued a bold challenge to Tecumseh and his brother. Harrison told the Prophet that if he was indeed the strong spiritual man he claimed he was, then he should prove it by performing a feat of magic. He told him to hide the sun and the moon, and to make the rivers run backward. The Prophet took him up on this dare, and told him that he'd cover the sun in 50 days. So Harrison agreed. He'd wait and return on the day of reckoning. And that day was here. As Harrison looks up at the sky, he starts to feel his anxiety steadily rising. To him, something was off. As the day approaches 4 p.m., he is consumed with total dread. He can only watch helplessly as the moon slowly approaches the sun and begins to pass in front of it. For 5 whole minutes, the world is plunged into darkness. A fiery ring blazes around the ominous circle of the moon as it eclipses the sun. On the ground, slivers of light penetrate through the trees. The water in the nearby river starts to flow a little differently, and an eerie silence falls on the clearing. For 5 minutes, Harrison is stunned silent. His gamble had failed. The Prophet had won the day, and the history of North America would never be the same. let's take a step back for a moment. First off, what are eclipses? And how are they important in the grand scheme of history? To help us answer these questions, we consulted with Randall Rosenfeld, archivist for the Royal Canadian Astronomical Society.
So I guess the simplest way to put it is when one celestial body, or the shadow of one celestial body, passes in front of another one. Another way to, or if you want to make it even simpler, is when a celestial body obscures another one. And it's that simple.
When talking about eclipses, it's important to note that there are two major types, lunar and solar. In a lunar eclipse, the sun's light casts a shadow of the Earth directly across to cover the moon, giving the moon an ominous crimson color. It's this color that gives lunar eclipses their nickname of blood moons. But it's the other kind of eclipse that interests us. Solar eclipses are when the moon passes between the Earth and the sun and casts a shadow that travels across the planet's surface. And among solar eclipses, the real showstoppers are what we call total eclipses.
It's the most dramatic. It's when the body which is being occulted is like totally blacked out, so you can't see it. And that causes all types of really strange effects, both optical and with the environment responding to this.
To give us a better picture of what it's like to be inside the shadow of a total solar eclipse, we turn to Dr. Andrew Layden, professor of physics and astronomy here at BGSU.
Now, if you're lucky enough to be in the moon's inner shadow, the deep dark shadow called the umbra, if you're there and you look up, you will see the moon completely covering the sun. And so you'll see a profoundly black circle surrounded by the softly glowing outer atmosphere of the sun, which is called the corona. This is a rare and really beautiful natural phenomenon. And at some point, birds start chirping like it's morning time. Sometimes if you're near a farm, the cows will decide it's nighttime and they go back to the barn. Right. So everybody starts going into night mode.
So why are we talking about eclipses to begin with? Well, in April of 2024, large parts of Mexico, the United States, and Canada will be caught in the shadow of a major total solar eclipse. It'll start in Mazatlan, then wind its way up through Dallas, Cleveland, and Montreal, then end in a spectacular journey off the east coast of Newfoundland. This will be a once-in-a-lifetime event for thousands of people, as an event like this isn't predicted to happen in the Great Lakes area for another 99 years. So when we talk about eclipses happening in the present, it's important to remember how they've mattered in history.
They've mattered very much. And of course, the way they've mattered varies over time. You know, as you'd expect. Give you a few examples. If you're looking at a particular discipline, looking at astronomy, it inherits the cultural stuff that went before it, and that could happen anywhere, which is sort of cool. And astronomers often, they look to where the earliest records and theories survive. And for the Western tradition, they often look to places like Babylonia or Greece. One example that comes to mind, there was this guy, he didn't live very long, but he was sort of mid to later 15th century. His name was Regiomontanus. And one of his most famous books was a collection of planetary tables, including eclipses. And those were quite popular. There's a story that Columbus was armed with those when he came to the New World.
And when Western astronomy came to the New World, it came into contact with the indigenous traditions of astronomy. And what these early Europeans found is that the inhabitants of the Americas were very learned astronomers themselves. Many indigenous civilizations across the Western Hemisphere had developed sophisticated methods of tracking celestial bodies. They could accurately predict when eclipses would take place at a time when European science was first developing its own prediction methods. And so, when Harrison made his challenge to Tecumseh and the Prophet, he was unwisely gambling in an area in which he was vastly outmatched. With all this in mind, it's time to jump back into our feature story.
So to understand the true impacts of the 1806 eclipse, it's important to know the context it took place in and the events that led up to that fateful day in western Ohio. In the years since the American Revolution, indigenous tribes across the Great Lakes region saw their land continually shrink as European American settlers steadily spread outwards from the original 13 colonies. Much of this territory was gained through bloodshed, as various indigenous tribes attempted to keep their ancestral homelands through fighting. A series of wars, first with the Revolutionary Americans, then with the U.S. government, had combined with the threat of disease to devastate indigenous tribes' military strength across the continent. In the old Northwest Territories, the loss of land was sharply felt amongst the Shawnee and the other indigenous tribes who inhabited the region. Amongst those who resisted white settlement was Blue Jacket, one of the preeminent Shawnee war chiefs of his generation. He led a loose alliance known as the United Indian Nations to several stunning victories against the United States, and he also served as Tecumseh's inspiration to take up arms. The alliance fell apart, however, after its defeat at the Battle of Fallen Timbers in August of 1794. The subsequent Treaty of Greenville formally ceded virtually all of modern-day Ohio and Indiana to the U.S. government. It also forced the relocation of many indigenous communities who hadn't agreed to the treaty or been part of the war at all. And when William Henry Harrison was made governor of the Indiana Territory in 1801, he had made it his personal mission to claim the entirety of the Old Northwest. With instructions from President Thomas Jefferson, he set out on a path to get those lands through any means necessary. Payments, threats, extortion, subversion, and brute force were all fair game to him. He concluded that one of the best ways to expand was to westernize indigenous tribes. Now, this was a complex process, and it was undertaken not only by the American government, but also by other colonial settlers in North America. Boiled down, westernization accumulates to several key features. Western settlers would encourage indigenous tribes to convert to Christianity, wear European-style clothing, and speak English instead of their own languages. This was all done in an effort to de-traditionalize Native American tribes and make them more susceptible to land acquisitions. And for a time, this strategy seemed to be working for Harrison. Alcoholism and poverty became endemic problems in the Old Northwest. Traditional culture began to fade away, and for the first few years after the Treaty of Greenville, acquiring more land for the federal government seemed easier than ever. It's in this environment where we first really meet the prophet. Although he was part of a family with a proud warrior tradition, he had never fashioned himself as one. He was present at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, but he'd taken a back seat when Blue Jacket's alliance collapsed. Traditional sources say he struggled with alcoholism for much of his middle age, and that it was during one of his bouts of frequent illnesses that he had his world-changing vision. During his epiphany, Tenskwatawa believed that the Great Spirit had shown him the true path for his people to regain their former glory. He began preaching a new set of messages to the Shawnee, emphasizing the rejection of European customs above everything else. He taught that alcohol itself was a harmful vice, and that all indigenous people could return to a time of prosperity before the various colonists came to the New World by rejecting everything that the West had to offer them. He said that by coming together and rejecting cultural integration with white settlers, especially the Americans, indigenous societies could rebuild themselves both spiritually and physically. He becomes incredibly popular for this, so much so that he's single-handedly able to gather enough moral support for Tecumseh to form a new alliance of indigenous tribes. His voice carried immense weight and authority. He became known as a local man of prophecy, and thus his name, the Prophet, was born. Today he's remembered as a powerful speaker and really as a kind of rejuvenating force for Native American religion in the 19th century.
The Prophet, as a sort of rising figure, prominent figure in this religious leadership role, which is an interesting concept to begin with in a culture that sort of has a problem with centralizing power, he makes these predictions and sort of promises this new way of life.
Fallon Silverhorn is a member of the Eastern Shawnee and cultural resource representative for the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. He's also an expert on early North American indigenous history.
Well, I mean, I think that was a lot of the sort of foundation of what he was saying is that there will be this return to a sort of golden age of native communities. And a lot of the religious leaders that pop up promise the same thing. It's a return to something, to this sort of perceived golden age of the past. And the way forward is usually whatever political motivation is associated with that.
It's the prophet's powerful message that rallies his people and other tribes together in the first decade of the 19th century. He's able to convince all these different people to come together in a time of really tremendous hardship, and he's able to convince them that his brother's ideas for a new alliance is really the way forward, not just for the Shawnee, but for all of them.
People like Handsome Lake and the prophet and these other sort of native spiritual leaders who pop up, they become these individuals that represent the whole of a spiritual movement, these sort of guru type figures. And oftentimes what it's sort of in front of is a political movement. So there's these religious leaders sort of creating new paradigms for culture and religion and identity and how you choose to associate with people. And then immediately following in behind that or in the wake of that or even side by side with it, political movements as well.
Without this religious revival, the coalition might not have been possible. Especially wouldn't have had as much authority as it did without the eclipse of June 16, 1806. Accurately predicting the eclipse as he did, the prophet was able to gain immense credibility and give a whole group of followers new hope for the future.
Making the prediction and it coming true. Like, the eclipse will happen, the ground will shake, the rivers will run backwards. Like, you know, this, I mean, that is a heck of a thing to hedge your bets on. But it does happen. And because of that, I'm sure exactly what, you know, the bewilderment and the like confusion that we might experience today, 200 years later, I can only imagine what people felt in the moment. You know, people who have been running and feel powerless, all of the sudden are standing in the presence of figures who can make the sun disappear and who, you know, can finally militarily challenge. Like, so Harrison challenged the prophet in his religious power to make these things happen. And I think that's the real key to it is, like, if Harrison hadn't issued that challenge and the prophet had just predicted it of his own personal, you know, if he just said, this is going to happen and it happened, would it have had the same effect as if it was a challenge that was being answered?
9 tribes joined Tecumseh's Confederacy in the beginning, and by 1808, they numbered in the thousands. That year, the two brothers decided that they'd found a town in northwest Indiana that would spearhead their entire movement. This town was, if you could guess, aptly named Prophetstown. Now, the exact size of this settlement is debated, but most historians estimate its population was roughly 6,000 people. It would have been the largest city in the Great Lakes region at that time, and it was not only a major center of religion, but also a bulwark to prevent the erosion of Native American culture. The majority of its population came from the Shawnee, Delaware, and Potawatomi groups, but it eventually grew to represent 14 different tribal affiliations that all formed the basis of Tecumseh's Confederacy. It didn't take long for rumors of their power to begin spreading rapidly, especially to the offices of one William Henry Harrison. When Harrison received word that Prophetstown had been founded and that it had attracted such a large population of ardent followers who were determined to resist westward expansion, he immediately saw it as a threat to his designs and the designs of the U.S. government. If those affiliated tribes decided to attack him, there'd be little he could do to prevent them from retaking large amounts of land in Indiana and Ohio. So he decided that he best strike first. In the fall of 1811, Tecumseh journeyed south to meet with representatives of the 5 civilized tribes, that is, the Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Seminoles, and Muscogee. He had hoped to bring them into his confederacy, and while he was away, he placed his brother in charge of making sure Prophetstown was kept safe. Not far away, Harrison had assembled his own force. Once he learned the infamous war chief was away in the south, he led 1,000 well-armed federal soldiers up to the gates of Prophetstown and demanded to meet with the prophet. They arranged a meeting for the following day, and Harrison encamped his men along a nearby river within sight of the town walls. The date was November 6, 1811. Now, it's unclear exactly how events unfolded in these next few hours. Harrison claimed that the prophet had launched an unprovoked surprise attack during the night, while other sources say he intentionally started a conflict by harassing several indigenous people who were returning to town from a hunting trip. It's likely that the prophet recognized the danger Harrison's men posed and thought he could deal with them if he struck quickly. Believing in his spiritual power, he sent between 600 and 700 warriors to attack the American camp. He told them that his spells and his prayers would protect them from American weaponry. Now, at first, the federal troops were taken by surprise, and a brutal melee ensued on both sides. They soon reorganized, however, and formed a defensive line that turned the tide in their favor. As they settled down for an hours-long siege, the prophet reluctantly had to come to grips with the fact that the element of surprise had been lost. His own leadership had been called into question when his spells and incantations didn't in fact protect his warriors from American bullets. With resistance to his leadership mounting, the indigenous warriors were ordered to withdraw back to Prophetstown after several hours of stalemate. By dawn, Harrison had dealt with the casualties in his camp and was now on the warpath. He marched his soldiers through the town gates, only to find the city abandoned. The prophet, now realizing that he was way in over his head, had evacuated his people in the night, leaving only empty buildings behind. Harrison ordered his men to set fire to the houses, and he even had them dig up the town cemetery as punishment for their attack. He later claimed that his men had killed over several hundred warriors, but most estimates say a few dozen is more accurate. On the American side, there were roughly 60 killed and 100 wounded. As the troops began their march back to headquarters in the east, they left the burning remnants of Prophetstown behind them. Within only hours, the culmination of years worth of spiritual and political unification went up in flames. The Battle of Tippecanoe was the beginning of the end for Tecumseh's Confederacy, and for Tecumseh himself. The prophet's authority was badly damaged after the debacle in the battle, and the cohesion of the tribes was falling apart. Without help from the tribes in the south, Tecumseh once again was forced to join with his traditional British allies. As tensions with the U.S. government grew to a climax, it was clear to all that some kind of destructive major conflict was looming on the horizon. Now, it's debatable whether Tecumseh trusted the British, but when weighed all together, they must have made a much more appealing ally to the Americans who were continuing to genocide and encroach upon their land. When the War of 1812 broke out, Tecumseh and his warriors became instrumental in defending the Northwest Territories from American invasions. The British, however, were hesitant to commit to their allies and continued to retreat back to a string of fortified positions in Michigan. After the American victory on Lake Erie in 1813, they were forced to once again retreat to Moraviantown, and it's there where they decided they'd make their final decisive stand. But when American troops arrived, the British commander took stock of his forces and decided that retreat was the better option than defeat. He'd seen how well-equipped and well-supplied the American impending forces were and how little he had to support himself and his men, to say nothing of his indigenous allies. So without notifying Tecumseh or his warriors, he simply retreated north into Canada. Finding themselves now abandoned, Tecumseh and his men were hopelessly outnumbered by the federal troops. Tecumseh himself was killed in the ensuing skirmish. The ultimate fate of his body has never been confirmed. The Confederacy, at this point, was ultimately finished. The prophet himself managed to flee into Canada, where he lived out several years in exile before returning to help relocate his Shawnee people to Kansas. He died in 1836 after having lost all of his religious and political credibility. The last great hope to resist American expansion into the old Northwest was gone.
It's tempting to think about what might have happened had the fateful events at Prophetstown not occurred on that cold night in 1811. The collapse of the Confederacy and its spiritual movement echo stories experienced by all indigenous tribes in the push for westward expansion. Because, remember, the U.S. government was fervent in pursuing the destruction and relocation of virtually all inhabitants of what is now the continental United States. We spoke with George Ironstrack, member of the Miamia, tribe and assistant director of the Miamia Center at Miami University, to understand the impact of this destruction.
So I have to preface this by saying that Miamia story of our language and culture is one, for the past 200 years, one of really large losses. So in 1846, we were forcibly removed from our historic homelands. In, you know, the late 1800s, early 20th century, our lands in Oklahoma were allotted. And then eventually a lot of our reservation, we lost direct control over it for many years. And it's only since the 1990s that we were able to recover and rebuild our economy and to use that economic stability to fund the efforts to rebuild and reclaim and revitalize our language and culture. So in that process, there's a lot that's lost. So a lot of the stories that would have been passed down orally generation to generation, not all of them, but a lot of them weren't passed down.
But the stories of indigenous societies in the United States are not only about loss. Communities continue to live on and continue to maintain their cultural traditions, but they also endeavor to make new traditions because no people are purely historical. For people like Talon Silverhorn, this push to separate from a narrative dominated by tragedy is essential.
A lot of people within our tribal communities internalize the idea, whether it's true or not, that we modern living people are like a pale reflection of what our ancestors used to be. It's one of these odd things where it's like, oh yeah, the ceremonies we do today, the way we live today, the way we dress today, the way we eat today, all of it's wrong and all of it's not the way we're supposed to do things. And so like a lot of people that have sort of internalized the idea that, you know, we have lost so much of our culture and identity and, you know, religion and such like that. They're all of it's based on the idea that those things are supposed to be historical rather than us being living modern culture today.
So in that wooded clearing in June of 1806, few could anticipate the momentous events that would soon follow. As the moon slipped away and the sun reemerged, the sense of wonder lingered. Events had been set in motion that would change the history of North America forever, all in the span of 5 minutes. And perhaps the most lasting legacy of the eclipse is what remains of those 5 minutes.
The way that a lot of Shawnee people talk about it, especially the prophet, a lot of that lasting impact of that sort of centralization of religious power has persisted into our modern community. And so there are people in Shawnee community today that follow the prophet's teachings, you know, that sort of are still holding to the idea that this religious revolution was the right thing and was the way to go. And the eclipse and the flowing of the Mississippi River backwards and all of these things are the proof that they point to, you know? And so, yeah, it does hold weight and power within our Shawnee community today. There are people who still believe that the prophet was exactly what he said he was. his interpretation of the eclipse and the function that it had in its time and what that meant for the galvanization of Shawnee people that were living then. I think that was probably the most long-lasting effect of that eclipse and its significance. That I think that the eclipse of 1806 and, you know, the predictions that he made and sort of the re-galvanization of Shawnee people coming back together from some of these scattered communities, all sort of beginning to centralize again. I mean, if that wouldn't have happened, yeah, we probably wouldn't be what we are today.
Thank you for listening to Eclipsing History.
This episode was designed and recorded by Sam Davis, Peter Lindbergh, and Joe Desario, students of the Public History Program at Bowling Green State University, under the direction of Cheryl Dong and Amilcar Chalou. Mid-story mixed and edited the episode. We thank our interviewees, George Ironstruck, Andy Layden, Randall Rosenfeld, and Talon Silver.
Brandon Cena composed the original music for the podcast. Ohio Humanities provided financial support. To access other episodes and additional content, please go to bgsu.edu/eclipsinghistory.